All right, if I could have your attention, every year we get an intellectual feast served up by an outside scholar of great distinction. We also have one served up by one of our own. This fall, we had Melissa Hart give us a wonderful talk in what is our Austin Scott Lecture. Next fall, Kristen Carpenter will be giving the Scott Lecture. This spring, in our Cohen Lecture, I thought, who would be an interesting academic who would represent the best that we academics have to offer? And the name that came to my mind was Dan Kahan. So Dan, for those who have not followed his career, has had a fairly meteoric rise, starting at the University of Chicago, where he went fairly directly after his clerkship. Is that right, Dan? Or did you? He blocked it out. There was a couple years of, and then he went to Chicago, and from there he went to Yale Law School. He has several strands or trajectories in his work. One of the most interesting and exciting is what is called the Cultural Cognition Project. And for those who haven't thought about how people's cultural, I'll use the word biases, color how they view issues, then you haven't read Dan's work, which, you know, looks at this issue from multiple takes. And what is really wonderful about his scholarship is it absolutely makes you think, and it raises and enhances your perspective. And once you take it on board, you will start seeing it in lots of places. He also has taken on being an empiricist, which was not his natural background. So for those of us here who've heard about the term, having a growth mindset, Dan's academic and scholarly career is phenomenal. I am very good friends and share a co-author with Dan, who is a trained statistician, and who said he's literally now been passed by Dan's work on statistics. This is quite an impressive accomplishment. He is not afraid to get into data, has analyzed it in lots of different ways, and has continued to contribute to our national conversation. Without any further ado, let me introduce Dan Kahan.
Hi. Oh, okay. Well, so that was a very generous introduction and exceeded only by the generosity of the invitation to be here. And I accept any invitation to come here because I really love it. I do that even though the first time I came, Sarah Krakoff sent me out on a run while I was almost eaten by a mountain lion. But she just said, well, that'll make you faster. And so that I guess I got that. But really, every time I come here, I feel like I'm 15% smarter after I leave. And I'm 10% already because I talked to some of Sarah's students. So it's pretty, you just have 5%. It shouldn't be too bad. But truly, it's just such, it's an honor. You know, the dean was saying what it is, what he's been doing. And I just want to say, well, I haven't really worked a day since June 30th, 1993, which was the day before my appointment became effective at the University of Chicago. Now, here's why I come here. I think I'm made smarter, but I'm inspired because what I see is the university that recognizes that for the privilege that we get as scholars in being really afforded this kind of leisure to try to satisfy our curiosity, we want to reciprocate by contributing knowledge that's going to benefit society. And that's just throughout this entire university, the spirit of all of the programs. The science that makes tremendous contributions to our knowledge, but also our knowledge of how to live well, to the social science departments where trying to perfect the institutions necessary to assure that people get the benefit of all that knowledge. And then I think of the law school really as kind of right in the center of that. Because in order to get the benefit of the policy relevant science, you need the person who plays the lawyer's role. That is the kind of unique kind of contribution that the lawyer is going to make. And the dean was saying, well, look, Dan has learned to do this and that. Here's what you teach lawyers in order to be able to perform that role. To learn whatever the heck it is you have to understand in order to bring to bear on the problem before you the kind of skills that you have. And I know that's the way that students are trained here, and I've seen it, and I find it inspiring. And so if you invite me to come and talk to you, then I feel like I'm doing something right. And I certainly want to try to satisfy expectations. Now, if I could remember what I was going to talk about. Well, you know, I think actually I'll tell you a story here at the beginning, because, you know, like a lot of people, they're kind of depressed about, well, because they think, you know, humans, we're really smart and everything, but these computers, they're becoming smarter than we are, right? So first they somehow beat us in chess, and I think most people were able to deal with that. But the Jeopardy business, that was really a crushing blow. But then, you know, it just got out of control, because along comes this computer. Now, it didn't have a name like Big Blue or Watson or something, so I just call it Lexi. But it was designed to be able to predict Supreme Court outcomes better than the human experts, right? So this is, you know, hitting pretty close to home. And they were going to have this big showdown, and all the cases for the term were there, and they collect all the renowned world experts from the law schools and the law firms, make your predictions and go up against Lexi, right? Now, we can kind of see Lexi's brain. Can you see other? I guess you sometimes can see humans' brains, but it's not sure what's going on in there. But with Lexi's brain, you can kind of see what's going on. I'll tell you anyway. It says, "Well, start. Is the lower court decision liberal? Yes. Reverse." You know, this is like one of the justices. Okay. Is it conservative? Is it coming from the Second Circuit? Now, some of them, it's more complicated. Is Justice O'Connor's predicted decision liberal? Yes. Is lower liberal decision liberal? Yes. Affirm. You know, it's like it's a kind of combination here of like the ideological predispositions of the judges as the computer modelers, political scientists have ascertained them, and the kind of covariance of the votes of the different justices who get arrayed in relation to each other, right, based on how over time they vote. And then you come up, they say, with this amazing program, Lexi, and it goes up against the experts. I don't know, maybe, I hope nobody's going to feel really bad after this, right? What a result. Well, the experts, they got 59% of the cases, right? That seems pretty good. But Lexi got 75%, right? And of course, you know, the people who do this kind of work, they go, oh, what a p-value! Was 0.007. It's almost like some insulting somehow. But in any case, you get, I think, two asterisks or something. Like it's almost little stars, because that's like less than point. Well, it must be. Now, you know, and then you see this kind of human. You get your nose rubbed in it, right? Like, and this is my colleague. I think he is a computer, but Ian Ayers, he writes, oh, look at the computers routed the experts and all of this stuff. It's really an amazing thing, and let's just live with it. Right. Now, there's just one small issue, though. You see, I mean, if you are kind of, well, even just kind of, kind of interested observer in the Supreme Court, I don't think you have to really be an expert. You know that the Supreme Court, it actually reverses the majority of its cases. It has a discretionary docket, and it's much more likely to take a case if it doesn't like the result. In fact, the reversal rate's about 70%, right? And so here's what I would recommend. I mean, Lexi was fed, you know, something like 600 cases over many, many terms and trained, you know, through this kind of regimen that I guess computers get trained. It's the equivalent of sit-ups and learned how to predict. Now, see, if I would have just taken somebody off the street and given them one piece of information. The Supreme Court usually reverses. I wouldn't even have to tell them that it's 70%. And I would say, now you make your best predictions for the upcoming term. You'll get a dollar for every one you get right. the person should just say reverse in every single case, because the person, there's a greater than 50% chance of not getting it right. If you say affirm for any, just say reverse for all of them, right? And so this is Mr. Non-Expert. And Mr. Non-Expert or Ms. Non-Expert, by the way, Linda Greenhouse kicked Lexi's ass. But if my person had been in the competition, well, my non-expert would have gotten 72% right, because the court reversed 72% of its cases that turns, which means that it would have gotten two less correct than Lexi. And I kind of figured out how to do this math. That's a p-value of 0.58, right? So, you know, I don't think that's really much to be proud of. Now, you know, actually, I kind of used the computer to figure this out. It's not the computer's fault. You know, a well-trained computer will give you good information. But Lexi, you see, didn't actually perform better than chance once you know that you're flipping a coin that comes up 75% heads. And it's not very good that the people who put Lexi together kind of weren't expert enough. Well, in what? I mean, it's the kind of most basic thing in the world. This is how you test the fit of a model that predicts the probability of things is to do better than somebody would if they just picked the most likely outcome. And it didn't, right? Now, you know, here's my topic. You know, are judges judicially, are they politically biased, right? And the public certainly thinks so. I don't know if this is like, you can see it, but like 76% of the people, it's a consensus, I guess, in some sense. Oh, the Supreme Court, it will decide cases on the basis of politics, right? And, you know, maybe people are just deferring to the experts because they say, oh, yes, that's true. You know, Lexi and Lexi 2, they've proven it, right? And, you know, I want to, if you ask me this question, are judges politically biased, I have a different answer. It's like, who the hell knows? You know, nobody's actually come up with a valid way to test this yet. It's a really important, interesting question, right? So here, I want to address the question, do we have reason to think the judges are biased? It's plausible that they could be, plausible that they wouldn't be. You know, more things are plausible than are true, and that's why you collect evidence. So I want to address the question, but I also want to see, you know, what counts as valid evidence here, right? So we do some studies. This one, this is called They Saw a Protest, and it's kind of a play on the title of a famous study in psychology from the 1950s. Probably a lot of you know it, but they take the students, in this case it was appropriate to use students, it's also, otherwise if you electrocute them it's not appropriate, but here they just say we want you to watch the film of a football game between your college and your arch rival, because there have been some suspicions raised about whether the referee was being fair. And so all the students, they weren't from University of Colorado because then they would have been impartial, but I think they were from like Yale, or the Yale students said, what's wrong? You know, this guy, he must be a Harvard alum or something like that. And Harvard students, oh, you know, probably New Haven corrupt politicians paid him off because he kept calling the calls against us. And this is the phenomenon of motivated reasoning, where people will conform their assessment of information. Here was their sensory, you know, brute sense impressions, but it could be their assessments of logical arguments or their assessment of credibility of experts, any kind of information, to some end or goal that is independent, really, of getting the right answer. And here the goal was experiencing this sense of connection to the group. Right? It was actually that the desire to participate and the solidarity with the institution was affecting what they see. That was the claim, and there have been lots of cool studies since that show this kind of thing. And so we're like, wow, could this happen in law, right? So we have our study, They Saw a Protest, and we take 200 people, kind of from a nationally representative sample. It could have been ones who would be eligible for jury service. In fact, they had to be registered voters. And we said, okay, now you're going to be playing the role of a juror here, right, in a case in which we have protesters who are suing the police for having broken up their protest. And the police say, well, we had to do that because these protesters, they were intimidating people and threatening them. In fact, blocking their access to a building. And the protesters said, that's not true. We were just engaged in peaceful advocacy, trying to argue with people. And they were annoyed by us, and they went to the police. And we said, well, fortunately, everything was captured on video. And both sides agree that the key facts are right there in the video. So just watch the video, we say. And then to figure out whose story is it more consistent with, the protesters that we were just engaged in speech, or the police who say, you crossed the line to intimidation. Now, there's they call it a manipulation. It's experimental manipulation. We manipulate people. We told half the people that the protest was at an abortion clinic, right? And the protesters were demonstrating against Roe v. Wade or against abortion rights. Told the other half that the protest was taking place at a university recruitment building when the military was in town to interview students who were interested in signing up, and that the demonstrators, they were against the policy, don't ask, don't tell, excluded openly gay and lesbian people from the military. I mean, a little before your time, but we used to have this long. We did this study a while back. And so we blurred out the messages on the signs. And, you know, you're supposed to look at the conduct. You're not supposed to be influenced by the messages on the sign, which had nothing to do, actually, with either of those things. And we also told the subjects to apply appropriate versions of a law that would, for this, the kind of protest that they were under the impression they were watching. And in one case, they were applying a law that said that you can't intimidate or threaten or interfere or obstruct the entry or the remaining on the premises of any facility that provides abortions. Right, that's, and if the police observe that, they have the authority to order you to stop and arrest you if you don't. And that's actually a real federal law, the Free Access to Clinic Entrances Act, FACE. But then we had another one. He said, well, you interfere with, obstruct, intimidate, threaten anybody who's trying to enter or remain in a facility that's engaged in military recruitment. Same thing, and the police can order you. You all know that that was at least considered in Congress. We had so much trouble, right? When we were, you do remember that? You don't watch Fox News, I guess, right? But it was considered. It wasn't passed. And we then asked the subjects, they watched the tape. We told them what the law was, and we said, watch carefully and see whether the people are engaged in the behavior that would justify the police telling them to stop. And then afterwards, we have them evaluate what the parties say are the facts. Things like, well, they were interfering, threatening, but also pretty specific things. Somebody was blocking somebody from entering the building. Somebody was screaming, right, in somebody's face. Those kinds of things would count as interference and obstruction, right? The Supreme Court, in fact, said so under the First Amendment in cases like this. Whereas if people are just annoyed, and we said where people were avoiding the building because they were just annoyed or embarrassed, and the police actually were motivated by the requests of the director of the clinic who's shown in one of the scenes, that wouldn't be acceptable, right? And actually, those are parts of the First Amendment standard as well as the relevant parts of the legal standard. Now, we also measured what we call our subjects' cultural worldviews. We call them that. That's because we use a framework from an anthropologist, Mary Douglas. That's what she called them, right? But the cultural worldviews, they characterize people's outlooks about how social relations should be organized along these two dimensions, right? They're pretty familiar, I guess, individualism and communitarianism. Do you think that people should take responsibility for their own well-being without assistance or interference from the collective? You're more individualistic. Do you think the collective is responsible for securing the conditions of everybody's well-being and can run roughshod over individuals and so forth? You're more communitarian. Do you think there should be lots of hierarchical, conspicuous rankings based on social roles? You're more hierarchical. Nobody should be able to tell the people what to do based on their identity or their things that they don't choose for themselves, you're egalitarian. And we have these scales. There's actually like six items per scale. But, you know, that people are agreeing or disagreeing at some level of intensity on this six-point measure with statements like, it's not government's business to try to protect people from themselves. If the government should stop telling people how to live their lives, our society better off if the distribution of wealth was more equal. Society as a whole has become too soft and feminine, right? These kinds of things. And then, you see, we basically identify people with groups whose members are characterized by their common adherence to the kinds of outlooks that are formed by the intersection of these two different kinds of understandings of how you should organize social life. Right? And you see, in our study, right, these are for us what the school affiliations were for the researchers, and they saw a game. Right? Our idea is that people have these kinds of important social affinities that are characterized or have included in them these shared understandings, and sometimes there are disputes that seem to pit their group against another, and when that happens, they're going to conform their understanding of the relevant facts to whatever outcome will be most consistent with promoting the well-being or status of their group, right? So we have these hypotheses that, well, the groups, hierarchical communitarians are more traditional, right? And they believe you should have important kinds of responsibilities to collective entities, including the family, based on roles that are connected to gender. They tend to oppose abortion. And the egalitarian individualists, you know, you can't condition the status of people on their assuming these kinds of domestic roles. Everybody gets the same kind of status for competing in the market, and so they tend to be pro-abortion rights. Well, they're probably going to form the kind of perceptions of facts that reflect those values. In the abortion clinic case, the egalitarian individualists can think, oh, the abortion protesters, they were kind of crossing the line. The hierarchical communitarians, they won't. But then they'll be turned around in the other condition, right? In part because it's about gay rights, right? And the hierarchical communitarian, you shouldn't be interfering with protesting against authority, but the egalitarian individuals, well, you can't tell somebody that they're not eligible for this kind of incidence of social status, military, based on their gender preferences. And the people who are hierarchical individualists in the egalitarian communities, they don't tend to get that worked up about abortion. But they kind of like, hierarchical individualists kind of like Marlboro Man. Like he likes guns, and that kind of enables the kind of characteristic male roles of hunter, protector, provider. It symbolizes the values of courage and self-reliance. And the military is kind of a symbol of that, but it's a very male symbol. And these people tend to think, well, there's something dissonant about having gay people in the military. And then you have the opposing view in the egalitarian communitarians. But, well, maybe that'll affect what they see, right? So, you know, the egalitarian individualists, if they're in the condition where they're watching the protest, they think it's the abortion clinic protest. They don't think the police should be liable. They had good cause for doing this. You don't enjoin them. That's one of the remedies that the protesters want in future protests like this. Right? The hierarchical communitarians, they say, oh, no, you know, the police didn't have any cause to do that in the abortion protest, and you shouldn't join them. Most of them said that. This is just the means for people who had these kinds of outlooks. But they flip around, right, if they think they're watching the military recruitment protest. And then the egalitarian communitarians and the hierarchical individualists, there's almost no agreement in the abortion clinic, but they're pretty polarized, too, in recruitment center. And really, people say they're seeing different things, right? Did the protester wave the sign in somebody's face? Did she scream at them? Did they block the building? Right? People with different values who think they're watching the same kind of protest, they disagree about that, right? But people who have the same values are disagreeing with each other if they're assigned to different experimental conditions and think they're watching a different kind of protest, right? So just like in They Saw a Game, people are conforming what they see to the outcomes that are associated with the sorts of positions that are characteristic of their groups. I actually didn't know. I thought, well, this will happen, but or could happen. What you can kind of keep grinding down the mechanisms. Like, why does this happen? And you know, do you ever see that it's a really great study where they say, okay, watch how many times people pass the ball, right? And they say, okay, how many times did the gorilla touch the ball? And you say, what gorilla, right? And the point is, a lot of your visual processing is virtual. You don't have enough space to take everything in, so you see enough and you kind of fill in the rest. But you fill in the rest based on what you expect to see. You don't expect to see a gorilla jump in and start to play the basketball, right? Well, here, they're filling things in, I figure, and they expect to see certain kinds of behavior at an abortion clinic protest or military. That's what I thought. But then I had a colleague who did the same study using the similar videos, and she was showing, actually based on another study we had done, people, the eye tracking, they're actually focusing their attention on the party they think is the one most likely to be engaged in bad behavior, right? So this kind of motivation to kind of collect the data, it's even before the data comes in. It's amazing, I thought, right? And that's consistent with the hypothesis. I could show you this kind of thing, you know, but the raw data is more interesting. Now, you see, this was the star of our movie. Maybe you recognize her because she's a successful Supreme Court litigant, right? Her name's Shirley. She's a member of the Westboro Church, right? It's a hate group. I mean, they're very happy. They want you to know they're a hate group. And they go to the funerals of soldiers who were killed in Iraq previously and in Afghanistan. And they say, well, this is happening because the United States is too tolerant of gays and lesbians. Right? And that makes the parents pretty angry. Right? And so one of them sued and got a judgment for, $5 million or something like this. And Shirley, she's actually a trained lawyer, and she litigates the case pro se, and Chief Justice Roberts only once had to tell her to kind of stick to it. It wasn't a bad brief. She actually won, and that down didn't surprise any like people who understand how the law works here, because the theory of the case was kind of on a collision course with one of the central pillars of the First Amendment. It's kind of like the non-communicative harm principle, right? I mean, here's what the court says. The record confirms any distress occasioned by Westboro's picketing. And there was distress, and there's plenty of evidence of it, and you'd have to be obtuse not to think that this is going to cause real trauma to people. It turned on the content and viewpoint of the message conveyed rather than any interference with the funeral itself, right? This is the non-communicative harm principle. You can regulate the speech, right, but only for interests that can be defined independently of any negative reaction to the idea. The kinds of harms you can experience that reflect a negative reaction to the ideas, those aren't cognizable. And here, the emotional harm turned on a reaction to the idea. If they'd been saying, well, you know, welcome, thanks for your service, you know, we appreciate it, there wouldn't have been this reaction, right? So it depended on that. Now, if you interfere with the funeral, you block the funeral procession, you hit somebody over the head with your sign, then you have a harm that can be defined independently of anybody's reaction to the idea. It doesn't matter what idea you're expressing, right? And so, of course, that would be permissible. And that's an important liberal principle because the state isn't picking sides here and protecting people's interests based on what their values are. It's recognizing the interests that people, regardless of their values, have as the kind of occasion for using law. Well, but you see, the problem is if you now in the next case, they're going to say, well, she had been interfering with the funeral itself. And if they respond in the way that they did in the study, well, then they'll just, you know, impute to Shirley, right? Or you know, here we had a case just last term where the Supreme Court had to deal with one of these abortion protest cases. And they said, Massachusetts, your law isn't good enough. Why don't you do it just like FACE? Because FACE is focusing people's attention on what they should be focused on under the non-communicative harm principle. But they can focus on the interference, intimidation, and so. But if, as a result of this kind of motivated reasoning, they impute the harm more readily to people whose values they disagree with, they'll be creating the very kind of bias on the basis of political views that the non-communicative harm principle was supposed to prevent in the course of deciding whether there was a non-communicative harm. That would be very, very bad, right? So Are judges politically biased? I don't know, because nobody's done a valid study yet. You see, these are ordinary members of the public. And you could try to extrapolate from members of the public, but actually the whole point of law school is to instill certain kinds of understandings of how to make sense of and apply the kinds of principles that implement the state's obligation to be impartial in disputes like this. Right? Does it work or does it not work? I mean, it begs the question to say that members of the public model what the judges do. So you have to do a study, you see, with judges. Right? There's a second study. They saw a statutory ambiguity, right? And we have 1,500 subjects, and 800 of them are members of the public, and the rest, students, lawyers, judges, about equally divided, okay? And we show them these ambiguous statutes, right? One of their judges are ambiguous. One of them says that it's against the law to leave debris in a national park. And here what happened is that the defendants, they placed reusable water containers in the desert along the Mexico-US border with the idea, well, these can be refilled, people can drink out of them. Is that depositing debris, right, in the national park? The other case was kind of a classic mistake of law problem where a police officer discloses confidential investigatory information to a private party, right? And the officer knows that that's private investigatory information. This is a private party, right? Doesn't know there's a law against it. And the law says anybody who knowingly violates this provision, well, does that mean you have to knowingly only know that you were disclosing information that was confidential to a non-governmental, then you're guilty? But you also have to know that it's in violation of the law, kind of mistake of law. And there are cases like this. I don't know why Congress never straightens this out, but all the time they come out one way or the other, right? But we have experimental manipulations, again, the parties. In one case in Littering, the group that left, the defense who left the water bottles, they were construction workers building a fence to keep illegal immigrants out. And the other, they're an immigrant aid group. It's putting the water out there in case anybody who's trying to enter the United States illegally by crossing the border is in need of water because it could be dehydrated. And that's not pertinent to, I don't think, is it, to the issue of whether that's depositing junk or debris in the desert. In one case, when in the disclosure problem, the police was tipping off religious family planning center that gives counseling on alternatives to abortion, that somebody had just applied for a job there who was a pro-choice activist under false pretenses. Watch out! Right? And in the other version of the problem, the police officer was telling a family counseling center that does give advice on birth control and abortion, you know, somebody from the pro-life group has actually applied for your job, hasn't told you about this, watch out! Right. Well, should that make a difference in the statute? And you see, we again measured the cultural outlooks. I don't know. There really wasn't, you know, these are continuous measures. You ask the questions, and, you know, they're normally distributed. And you can see kind of, there really isn't that much difference, you know, between the subjects here. A little bit, you know, but you explain a tiny portion of the variance. It was kind of interesting. They're not that different, the members of the public and students and judges and lawyers, in our sample. And we have hypotheses. Well, the hierarchical communitarians, the same thing as in the, they saw a protest that feel ways about abortion in the disclosure case. They're going to think the police officer should be punished if he was, the hierarchical communitarians, if he was advising the pro-choice clinic, but not if he was trying to help the pro-life group out, and the other way around for the egalitarian individualist. We thought the hierarchical individualists and the egalitarian communitarians, they would be forming opposing reactions in this kind of case, right? Now, you know, what do you think is going to happen with the judges and so on? Now, realize, because we teach you what we here at the law school, we're focusing on critical reasoning, right? And critically re-examining your intuitions and thinking analytically. You know this kind of, this is a popular understanding now, the dual process theory. There's system one and system two. System one is kind of rapid, fast, emotional reactions that the members of the public have, and they screw up in comic ways. Whereas the experts, they're more deliberate and thoughtful and analytic. That's what we're trying to teach the law students, right, to do. And that's what you have to do to be a good lawyer. So you might think that's going to help counteract the kind of bias that we're talking about, right? You could think that. But that would actually not be a very good hypothesis, because we've done studies that show that this dynamic I'm talking about with cultural cognition, this form of motivated reasoning where you're conforming your understanding of the policy relevant facts or risk to your cultural identity, is magnified by one or another of the kinds of reasoning proficiencies that are characteristic of system two. People use their numeracy, they use their cognitive reflection, they use their science literacy to do an even better job of fitting the evidence to their group's view. To me, that's the strongest reason to worry that the judges and the lawyers and the students are going to be really bad here. Now, in fact, we do mainly studies of risk perception, right? And that's why we use this framework. And Mary Douglas had this account of who's going to be worried about what. Right? And we do studies, we find, you know, all kinds of these patterns, they kind of make sense. You know, all the hot button issues, the kind of things, you haven't met somebody before, you avoid getting into a conversation about that and so forth. Right? And in addition to measuring our subjects' cultural values, we looked at their risk perceptions, right? Some environmental risk perceptions that we thought would divide the hierarchical individualists, the egalitarian communitarians. Also, we would call them social deviancy risks. Like the hierarchical communitarian doesn't like the marijuana legalization, but thinks it's dangerous, right? Conforms understandings of the risk to that. Like, oh, that's very dangerous. You have marijuana legalization. Is it? By the way, I came to do some empirical research. Right, the abortion is very dangerous. You know, anti-terrorism things are good. You know, egalitarian individuals, oh, anti-terrorism makes us worse off, but these other things are okay. You know, and the public was polarized on the global warming, just to pick one of them. So were the students, lawyers, judges. And they're polarized. I don't think, you know, well, same on the social deviancy risks. I don't know, the sizes vary a little bit, but not in ways that make you think that the lawyers and students or judges are less biased. I don't know if they're more, but yeah, same pattern. Right? So now we look at but we want to know about the understanding of the law. Right? So with the public and the judges. And in this first case, the disclosure, where the police officer, he's telling either the pro-choice or the pro-life clinic, watch out, you're being infiltrated. And members of the public, they're kind of evenly divided, right, as to whether there's a violation. It doesn't matter which condition they're assigned to. In the littering example, where you leave the bottles in the desert, it's still kind of evenly divided, especially in the construction worker. You know, I half say yes, half say no. A little bit of a more likely to say that the immigrant aid group, when they left the water bottle out there, that they were violating the law. And, you know, these are ambiguous, genuinely ambiguous problems. So, you know, why wouldn't you expect them to kind of be unsure? But you see, the judges, they're not unsure at all. You know, they're converging pretty strongly on the position that in disclosure, that's a violation. It doesn't matter which version, pro-choice or pro-life. They're converging pretty strongly on no violation in the littering, whether it's the immigrant aid group or the construction workers. But we want to know about the cultural outlooks. And there you get the kind of characteristic pattern along the lines predicted with the public and the littering. In disclosure, I don't know if it's a little less dramatic, but when they're not so far apart in pro-choice, but when you come to pro-life, the egalitarian individual is very mad. You violated by telling them that the pro-choice activist was trying to infiltrate, and higher communitarian less likely to say that. The judges, you know, well, the egalitarian communitarians, you know, they're actually less likely to convict than the construction. It's going in kind of opposite direction. And say, but you know, those are just tiny little differences. You know, you're not seeing it there. And look at this, look at my cool regression model. Like, and people do that, you should say, you know, that's ridiculous. I mean, I want to show you, first I'll show you the raw data. If I'm doing an experiment saying this is what's going to happen, you should be able to see it, right? Then you should say, well, you know, test it, your inference, discipline it with some appropriate kinds of statistics, and these are appropriate, but you still can't figure out this out even if you understand it. You know, what can I do to help you understand this? You've got a model here. It's taking all these different kinds of relevant characteristics. Are you a judge? Are you a lawyer? Are you a member of the public? Were you assigned to this version or that version of the problem? And it's estimating how much of a difference each of those makes. Well, I can plug those numbers in, right? And I can plug them in over and over again, adding a little bit of error each time to correspond to the precision of the estimates. And basically, you know, here's the prediction. Well, okay, on average, if a member of the public is assigned to the hierarchical individualist in the construction worker version, about 40% likelihood of finding that there was a violation. Right, but given the error, right, there's a kind of entire probability distribution. You can see it's about plus minus 7%. All the values are squeezed in between that interval, right? And then I say, okay, but see, what if he's assigned to the immigration rights version, right? You know, you can just see that these are very different values, and in fact, well, 34% difference in the likelihood, 34% more likely to say there should be a violation in the condition that is affirming of where conviction is affirming of the hierarchical individualist values, right, in that version of the experiment. And the egalitarian immigrant rights version, you know, again, big difference there, and difference too, 22% more likely, 22 percentage points more likely to find the violation because that result is now culturally affirming to you if you're the egalitarian communitarian, and it's the construction workers, right? So they're being very strongly affected, and you see similar things going on, a little bit less drastic, but still there, right? Still the kind of things you wouldn't want to see. Now with the judges. I mean, oh, those are different. It's not significantly different. Who cares? I mean, it's in the opposite direction even from what you would have worried about if you thought that the judges were trying to decide the case in a way that was influenced by their cultural values. But in any case, you just get a bunch of overlapping estimates. There's no real difference. And the same thing with the disclosure, right? Now, you could think about it this way. What, you know, I could average, how much more likely is a subject of a certain kind to find a violation in either of these problems if the finding of a violation will affirm that person's cultural commitments than if the finding of a violation will disappoint or offend the person's commitments? And for the members of the public, it's 22 percentage points more likely to find the violation when it's affirming, right? Plus or minus 6. And the judge, I don't know, you know, I've got fewer judges, but it's just not the same thing, right? They're just not being biased. And I can do this with the lawyers and the students. Lawyers look pretty much like the judges. Oh, well, the students look a little bit like the public, you know. Look, do this kind of thing again, you know, really looks like the judges. Well, it's a little bit more like the public, but, you know, you're learning. You're getting your money's worth. Don't worry. It's a good thing that you're paying the tuition because you can acquire. What are you going to acquire here? Right? See, I'm going to tell you about this result. I mean, obviously, you pit hypotheses against each other that are plausible. And one is that the judges will be biased. Why? Because, well, it appears that way to people. There's certainly a temptation. We know that this kind of dynamic exists. And we know, too, that it's magnified by the kinds of reasoning proficiencies that we're trying to instill in the judges. But there's an alternative hypothesis that says, you know, judges here are going to be approaching this using professional judgment. And professional judgment is very distinctive. Right? The best account of it focuses on pattern recognition. I mean, use pattern recognition as kind of like a rapid kind of assimilation of cases to inventories. You know, that's how we recognize faces, and, well, that's a cat, even though it's missing a tail and an ear. You know, and experts do this too. They acquire the kind of an inventory of cases that are prototypical, that fit what it is that they're trying to do. I mean, the classic case is this: people in chess, right? So, like, they don't think 45. Well, he thinks 5,000 moves ahead, but he has like an inventory. You know him. He has an inventory of all of these past experiences. Oh, that looks more like the board position. That's good for me, right? Or the aerial photography surveillance experts. So they're kind of like looking at the patterns. That looks like a Cuban missile, you know, or something. Or you're an auditor and you're getting dumped with this big pile of data. You go, you know, oh, that looks like, I think I smell, you know, fraud or something like this. And actually, it's not an alternative to System 1 and System 2. System 1 and 2 is, well, you know, there's people who are kind of intuitive and people who are more analytic. The pattern recognition, it says, well, these are integrated and reciprocal kinds of ways of thinking, right? So you have medical expert. The medical expert has to be very proficient at kind of making inferences from evidence and going with the results of tests and not getting stuck on the preconceived notions. But if the medical expert doesn't, at the beginning, in seeing a case, form a plausible hypothesis set, right, on the basis of the kind of acquired prototypes that are part of pattern recognition, the likelihood that he or she is going to be testing the right possibilities is unacceptably low. So the expert has these very good intuitions and recognizes the right kinds of cases. Why? Because the person also happens to be very proficient in critical reasoning and over the course of experience trains, habituates him or herself, gives herself positive, negative reinforcement, comes to recognize these things in a pretty reliable way, and they both work together. That's very similar to an account that Carl Llewellyn had about how judges and lawyers think. And a lot of people think they have this vulgar view that Carl Llewellyn said, oh, law is indeterminate. You know, it's what the judge had for breakfast. He actually hated that view. That was another legal realist, Frank. And in fact, he did say, yeah, the law is indeterminate. And he has like these interesting, you know, demonstrations of that with the canons and so forth. But the question that really motivates him is, gee, given that I can see using just simple reasoning that these rules don't uniquely determine the outcome, why is there so much agreement among the lawyers and judges? It is practically, it's very determinate. They all know what the result's going to be, even though it mystifies me. And he said, that's situation sense. And when he described a situation sense, he was thinking of pattern recognition. They're immersed in a common professional culture, and they come to recognize situation types. And reliably, they're focusing on the thing that matters, right, and ignoring the thing that doesn't in a way that people who aren't having that kind of experience, acquiring that inventory, won't do. And that's what we think is going on here. But you see, that theory about why it is the judges and lawyers might resist the motivated reasoning, because they're focusing on what's pertinent and blocking out what isn't, because they have that finely tuned situation sense for the law, it implies that outside of the area of expertise, the judges won't be any better than members of the public. And they aren't on the risk perceptions. All right? So I'm almost done, but are the judges, you know, are the judges politically biased? And two answers. One is, well, the study doesn't prove that they aren't. Right? It's only giving you more evidence, I hope, right, that makes one or another plausible claim more convincing than otherwise it would have seemed to you before. You get more evidence, right? But that's all that you ever do with valid studies. But here, this is the more important thing, I think. These two studies together, they imply that the public is likely to perceive that judges are biased in these culturally contested cases, even when the judges are, in fact, resolving them in a way that is valid on the basis of appropriate considerations and neutral in the sense that you would expect them to do. Margolis, whose work we're basing our view of the professional judgment and pattern recognition on, used an account like this to explain conflicts over risk. He said, well, members of the public, they don't have the experts' prototypes. Right? And sometimes when the experts are converging, members of the public, they can't see what the experts do, and you have these conflicts. There are other kinds of mediating prototypes. They recognize who an expert is. But sometimes there's some kind of dynamic that interferes with the kind of mediating prototypes, and you end up with this persistent conflict. It's not because the experts are biased. And we say, okay, cultural cognition is one of those kinds of dynamics that can actually interfere with the kind of ability, the pattern recognition ordinary people use to recognize who the experts are. And we say this is the science communication problem, right? That doing valid science doesn't by itself communicate its validity because the people who you're communicating with don't have the kind of professional judgment that allows them to recognize the validity intrinsically. You have to communicate to them the kinds of things that they would use, and they usually ordinarily do very effectively, to say, oh, yes, that's what the experts believe. And we have problems with that on some of these kinds of issues. Well, there's a parallel problem, right? Cultural cognition and the neutrality communication problem, right? I mean, the study they saw a game, that's modeling people. Modeling people seeing controversies like this, right? They see maybe the videotape or just hear something. And they're filled with conviction about what happened. Right? And law students are too. Because these kinds of these kinds of events are filled with a kind of significance, and they're caught up in these kinds of competition between plural groups in a modern democratic society. And people see, what, just like the students, the kinds of things in these controversies that promote the status of their group. Now, the judges, we want them to decide exactly those kinds of controversies in a way that evinces an appropriate neutrality on the part of the state with respect to these groups. And, you know, it was 8-1 in Snyder v. Phelps. It was 8-1 in the McCullen versus Coakley. But, you know, those cases were decided correctly. I don't think lawyers are surprised. But their being decided correctly does not communicate to the public the validity of the decisions, the neutrality of the decisions, if they were, because members of the public don't have the same kind of inventory of patterns that allow them to recognize the situation type, focus on what's pertinent and disregard what isn't, right? They're gonna see, you know, are judges politically biased? They're gonna say, of course, right? Because half of every time the case is decided, half of them thinks the court is, there's not really consensus on this either, right? It's like as if you're at the football game and after every play, half the stadium wants to kill the referee, right? And that's because, you see, well, just as doing valid science doesn't communicate the validity of it, and you have to have a separate understanding of what the mechanisms are by which people can reliably recognize with the prototypes the situation sense they have for doing that, it's pretty remarkable. You know, that they're able to recognize much more science as being valid than they could ever possibly comprehend or verify, because they're really good at figuring out what's known. Well, but you better figure out what those processes are and how they can be disrupted, because the value of that science is much too great to kind of leave these things to chance. And the same thing here. We have a neutrality communication problem. It's not enough. Even if the judges are doing a great job, you know, and this is evidence one way or the other, but you see, however much evidence we might have that they're deciding neutrally, we have more than ample evidence that they're not making the validity of the decisions accessible to people who don't have the kind of situation sense and professional judgment that would be necessary to evaluate the cases as acts, as the exercise of professional judgment. And in fact, that is part of the value that the court is delivering when they decide these cases, not just a neutral resolution of them, but the assurance to people who can see what's going on that in fact the state is not picking sides in these controversies. Right? If they're not communicating that, then they're not actually doing the job as well as they should. That's a deficit, you see, in our professional craft, as impressive as it is. And it's one, you see, that we should be using, well, experimental methods like these, we should be using empirical methods to figure out, you know, how can we be as good at conveying to the public the validity of these decisions as we are making them, right? And so that's what this is about. And I'm using this experiment, and so far hasn't worked, but I'm still trying. So that's that. Very talented.
We have a little time for some questions. Let me see if a student would go first.
Yes, since you were shown to be biased.
Because they're more biased, after all.
No.
They can defend themselves. Sure, Jess over here, and then we'll go to Christine.
One thing that I find interesting is how the public perceives that bias, and I think the role of technology that's been playing in media consumption. I'm just curious how you've been able to deal with that variable in your research.
Like how the media plays into it.
Yes. And
well,
technology and then the rate of consumption.
Yeah, I mean. Although, you know, there is this kind of claim, oh, the echo chamber, and like it's, you know, the internet is, and the best evidence of the echo chamber is that the kind of, like, the reverberations of this theory that kind of continues to, like, people can, even though there's no evidence for it. Actually, most people don't, I mean, there's a lot of that traffic on the internet, billions and billions of Twitters. Do you know what fraction of them have anything to do with politics, you know? And if you say something like, you know, James Hansen, people say, oh, it's too bad he's dead. There's no more Muppets. They don't know any climate scientists. You know, some people will go on Amazon. You want to get the book, More Guns, Less Crime. And they'll say, oh, here's 50,000 other books. You know, and this isn't even Watson's stupid cousin that can figure out that that's the right algorithm, because people are out there searching to get the stuff that reinforces their view. You know, you want more guns, more crime. Oh, here's 1,000 other books that say exactly the same thing. Right? So that's being enabled by the internet. But most people are getting, you know, the book, Everything I Needed to Know I Got in Kindergarten. Oh, okay, maybe like this. But I did learn a couple interesting things in second grade, too. You know, the number of people watching the, you know, Riley and Maddow, 10 times as many are watching America's Funniest Pet videos and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of intermediaries out there. Once the message gets out there, people are pretty motivated to deceive themselves. Right? I mean, there's no media telling them one thing or the other in those videotapes. They already, I mean, maybe they've been made that way, I don't doubt it, by influences that were conveyed by the media. But once they know that that's the kind of position of their team, then they will themselves, right? They'll create the demand for the kind of misinformation that's out there. And so I think the media is part of it. There's no question. And here's the, and even more, I mean, it's devastating, but you know, you can't, even if you know all of these mechanisms, you're not in control of how all these things go out there. And so clearly that's part of the problem with the courts. You know, how's the media going to play this? You know, but, you know, maybe something like Scalia. Scalia, frankly, you know, he's a vandal. If he doesn't like what he wants, he defaces, you know, the facade of, I mean, you can say something's wrong and still say it's valid. And this is actually, you know, enabling exactly that kind of discourse. So, you know, the question is what in our practices can be used to help to regulate that? And how can we compensate for those dynamics?
Just prior to coming to law school, I was working with on a construction site, overseeing an environmental team whose responsibility was picking up water bottles that construction workers left on the ground. So I'm curious as to
were they refillable ones?
That was my ground going with this.
Yeah. Yep, in both of them, it said that there was the parties anticipated that they left them unattended, and there was no question that there would be periods of time when they were empty. I mean, and also that they're full. But the idea was that, oh yes, there was the intention was to come back and refill them and reuse them, either for the construction workers or for these other people. Yeah, and I think there is such a regulation. It is my pretty strong intuition that it's not thinking about that, even though that might be a problem for either construction workers or immigrant aid people to do. I don't think that's what they were getting at. So.
I guess my main question about this work, my doubts about this work, is a sense that it doesn't go far enough in confronting the way bias is embedded, not only broadly in social structure and in commonly accepted notions of what is true, but insofar as we're talking about judges, in the law itself. And it's a convenience for judges, and a convenience for people who are skeptical about the notion that judges are biased, that the law itself might reflect very consistently the biases that judges tend to have. This is something that Lily Horvath studied a long time ago, historically, about judges vis-a-vis injunction cases in the labor context.
That's really important. No, I'm really glad that you make that point, because actually, I kind of like this analogy. But you know, the chick sexer in the poultry industry is very important. Like the you have to separate out the male and the female chicks, like, you know, very quickly. And like the female chicks you want to keep, because they're gonna be more tender meat. They lay the eggs. The males are kind of scrawny. They peck at the. You save some of them. They live a kind of charmed existence. But you throw the rest away right away. You know, and there are these guys, the chick sexers, and it's coming down the conveyor belt. And there's hundreds of them. You know, they go, you know, male, female, and their accuracy rate is astonishing. You know, and they're vital to this industry. We all really should be thanking them, I guess. Oh, I'm a vegetarian myself, but and you ask them, how do you do it? And some go, I don't know. And then others go, well, you know, the male chick is ear twiver, you know, it's this confabulation, right? Well, how do they learn? They go to chick sexing grandmaster school, where they say, look, male, female, male, male, female. And eventually they just kind of acquire the pattern recognition, right? Now, I say to my students, you know, proximate causation and, you know, the dangerous proximity and with, you know, why? And they say, because the chick's ear rose. You know, they're learning the situation types, and I think it's similar. And then I say, but here's the difference. I know what the chick sexer is doing is valid, right? The chick sexer is not just reliable, like, you know, getting it right. He is. But the chick sexer is also, we know, successfully figuring out who's the male and the female chick. You are being made reliable. But is the judgment that you have as a professional valid? Is it actually connected to what it should be? That's a separate issue. And all of the kind of training is about making you be reliable. And it's your duty to think, because you're participating in constructing the situation sense, is it valid? So it wouldn't be any comfort to say, they will reliably converge on the out, regardless of their ideologies and backgrounds and genders and ethnicity, on the position that screws the working class, or something like that. And so I think what you're saying is perfectly consistent with this. It wouldn't be any good to have a professional judgment that was reliably attuned to doing something that it wasn't what we wanted in our best moral understanding of the law to do. And if that's not a point, actually, we've made in the draft, and we should, and you're absolutely right about that. So, yeah, it doesn't go far enough to that. I hope, though, it at least poses the question. I mean, I try to get my students to think about it, and anybody who doesn't, you know, you're just kind of, you know, you got to make them think about it, even though you got to make them be chick sexers.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. I wonder what you could tell us, what we know about how experts get moved off pattern recognition in good or bad ways. In other words, are there moments when there are two competing patterns and that's the problem? What do we do when we have an expert where there's one pattern and the expert gets it wrong? I'm thinking here as lawyers, you know, there's a moment, there's a strategic moment lawyers might understand about pattern recognition, which is when do
Yeah. Well, and you know, sure. And of course, you know, the literature on the professional judgment is really vast and fascinating. And it's not the case that experts don't make certain kinds of biases, signature ones. You know, they might even have like a kind of this is a fascinating one about wildfires. Like, nobody can really tell like the dynamics of the wildfires. They kind of, it's like one of these classic chaotic systems. But there are these guys, the guys who fight the wildfires, and they just kind of uncannily know all of this stuff. But sometimes, like, something in the background, like, distracts them or confuses them about what type it is, and they actually perform less well. I mean, you know, that's kind of like they don't know what they know because it is in the wrong, they couldn't find it or something. That can happen. It's just a characteristic kind of bias, and there are confirmation biases or, you know, even hopeful thinking biases and all of that. I would say, though, that if you think pattern recognition works well, there is a kind of problem with inertia, that people will become attuned to the patterns that they're trained with and that are working. And in particular, there is this efficiency of kind of picking the right kind of set of plausible hypotheses quickly and not wasting your time on a whole bunch of other things, right? But if, in fact, the probability, the frequency of these other things is increasing, you know, outside of the experience of the people with the patterns, yeah, then that will be a problem. Although knowing that that's what the mechanism is that makes professional judgment usually work well should help you to understand, you know, or to anticipate, you know, something like that. It's actually, there's this great talk I went to the other day where it showed that kids are really good at, like really difficult causal inference problems. Like, they would show them these patterns, you know, like, this goes with this, and this goes with this. And they go, what do you have to do to make this happen? They go, oh, it's obvious. Take three of those, and then you add this on top. And these are like little three-year-old, four-year-old kids. And adults couldn't do it as well. And in fact, as you got older, you got less and less able to do it. But her point was that, you know, we think that the really high part of reason is all of this kind of causal inference. Actually, that part's kind of easy. What isn't is kind of knowing what the plausible possibilities are. And their experiments were set up so that none of the things that were happening were kind of like typical things. And so these kids, you know, without the burden of having to make good hypotheses, are just picking out these crazy ones and getting it right. And so a lot of getting smart is learning to actually kind of constrain yourself and not think as kind of widely about the possibilities. But that obviously raises exactly the kind of concern that you're getting at.
Last question from a community member. Anyone want to ask one? Anyone this side of the room here? All right.
Somebody in the back?
Where is that last question?
So I have a sort of non society question.
Yeah.
Be able to communicate something about this particular kind of
well, so, yeah, I mean, those are related, but if I think of them separately, you know, I think that the students are better, and we kind of, we use a variety of kind of, like, we don't just do, like, things with p-values and whatever, but you can kind of see that the evidence we're getting is much more consistent with the hypothesis that students, you know, they're not immune, but they're maybe half as vulnerable to the impact is about one half or something like that, and there you can see that it's making a difference, and you know I imagine they get better. But the point is, if somebody says to me, "Oh, I think there's a problem with legal education and how we do it," I couldn't say, "Oh, look at our study," because I don't know if what makes people lawyers acquire this reliable situation sense. How much of it comes from law school? How much of it comes from training? If there's a part of it that comes from law school, would it be better if you did things that critics of legal education now are saying we should do instead? Would they acquire it more readily if they just, you know, did apprenticeships after a year? I don't know. You know, but I think that we should understand that part of what we're trying to do and educate the students is help them acquire the professional judgment and also acquire the kinds of habits of mind and expectations that will make them more readily acquire it as they go along. That's probably more realistic. The issue of could we remedy, though, the kind of what I'm calling it the neutrality communication problem by trying to populate, you know, trying to more widely disseminate the pattern, you know, the recognition. And I don't think that, first of all, I think anybody, any curious member of the public who wants to understand these things, you know, it ought to be able to get the benefit of information about that. And any law professor who wants to help a member of the public do that is doing a good thing. The same way a scientist who's trying to help a member of the public understand things is doing a good thing. But the truth is that people have way too much to do than to become experts on all the science that they would have to make decision, you know, have to actually incorporate into their lives, personal lives, business lives, civic lives, that, you know, to rely on that, rely on scientists teaching them how to think like scientists. And same thing with people in the law. They have too much to do. There has to be some civic kind of situation sense
that is reliably attuned to recognizing valid law? And I think there is, right? And I think that we should work harder to understand how, what we're doing, we connect reliably with that. It's a good idea to help the people understand the law, but I think the idea that, oh, the way to solve this is to teach people more law is kind of similar to the, what I would say is a mistake of the way to fix climate change is to teach everybody how to be a climate scientist. I mean, that's not that, you know, teach people, well, help create the conditions in which people use their normally reliable faculties for recognizing when people they expect to do the job right are doing it right.
I want to thank Dan Beyer next door.